When some of them passed me while I stood leaning against the wall of the shaft, they greeted me without, however, stopping or putting any questions. Their faces were rather handsome in most cases, and a few women were very beautiful. Only their eyes had a kind of dismal expression. None of them laughed, and those who talked to each other while they passed from one building to another spoke in an exceedingly low voice. The people wearing cotton chupa were quite different. They were more numerous than the other variety and seemed to be the servants of the colony. There were even children belonging to that category. This class of people was rather horrible to look at. They behaved like automatons, and their eyes strangely resembled the eyes of corpses. I began to feel a little uncomfortable. But then I thought of beautiful little Dolma, so full of life and enthusiasm, and of Narbu, who was so clever, energetic, and kind-hearted. Could such people introduce me to a body not serving the purpose of light? Had I not been told that the City of the Initiates took a stand for the most lofty principles? Did it not work to help the world? And then everything about the city seemed to be so tidy, so practical, so remarkably well organized. The very plan of the city bore the unmistakable stamp of genius. A few children dressed in cotton garbs passed the wall, carrying heavy packages. A little girl dropped a parcel just while she passed me. I stooped to help her to pick it up. Our eyes met. I had never seen such eyes in a child. There was no life in them, no joy, no enthusiasm, only the monotonous expression of a mechanically working intelligence. She took the parcel without saying a word or smiling, and passed on. Footnote. Again I had to think of a robot or a wandering corpse. At that moment one of the adult automatons, dressed in a chupa, approached me, gazed at me lifelessly and said, "My lord, our guest, Lamochon Vertical Bar will meet you at the entrance of the palace." I walked to one of the staircases directed by the lifeless servant. A young lady, elegantly dressed in pure white silk of excellent quality, ascended the staircase and met me smilingly. "Welcome," she said in a very low voice. "We knew that you were coming." "I arrived here this morning," I replied in Tibetan, "but had not the pleasure to meet anybody at first." "We rise very late in the holy city," she replied. "Breakfast is served in the dining house." She pointed to one of the other glass roofs, "at 1 o'clock. All our members and guests are present then." She glanced at my equipment. "I shall have these things transported to your room." She beckoned to one of the servants dressed in cotton. Footnote. Only once I met two children in the city who seemed to be really alive. They were probably children of members. Tibetan gown. Percents the little goddess. Chupa, who got hold of my belongings. "You will live in the guest house over there." The servant walked away with my things. "Yo, you are the second white person who visits the holy city," she said, and then she added in broken English, "There have been several people here from India, but only one from the West." "Has he returned?" I asked, this time in English. "No," she answered. "Unfortunately, he died here. He is buried in the holy city. Would it be too much to ask you to have someone show me his grave tomorrow?" I hazarded. "By no means," she went on in fairly comprehensible English. "I will show it to you myself." We walked a few dozen yards to the next staircase. "This is the temple building," she said. "We call it Lakang." She pulled out a golden key and unlocked the door. "Please, my lord, step in first." Decidedly they were very polite in the holy city. We entered a corridor. The light was almost too strong for one's eyes, the whole roof being made of glass, and brilliant daylight flooding in through the whole ceiling. She unlocked the heavy door opposite and threw it open. The walls were covered with strange magic signs and songs. Footnote. "This is the dead house," she said. "When someone dies in the holy city, his or her remains are kept here until burial." "For how long?" Footnote. "Magic formulae. For 7 days," answered Lamochun. "There are 3 floors in this building," she went on. "The dead house is on the top floor, our temple is on the floor just below it, and the burial place is on the floor under the temple." We walked out and she carefully locked the door. On going downstairs we passed the door of the temple, which seemed to consist of massive gold. Perhaps the layer of gold was superficial, but even in that case the illusion was complete. "I am sorry I cannot show you the temple," she said. "Only the members of the Holy Brotherhood are allowed to enter. The guest's special permission of him, our prince, is required, but he is not in the city at present." We went downstairs to the lowest floor. The light in the corridor was very dim as it came successively through three glass ceilings. She again pulled out a golden key and unlocked a large hall. "This is our cemetery," she said. "You will find the grave of the Westerner in the corner over there. It is the second from the right." I walked up to the stone slab. A Tibetan name was written on it. I read it very carefully but found that it did not sound Western at all. He was probably buried under the Tibetan name by which he had been known in the city. I was lingering before a few other stone slabs when she said, "If you like, I will show you rapidly the other buildings. As he is absent, I can even show you his private garden. If we hurry up a little, I can show you all the buildings in the holy city except, of course, his palace. I hope he will grant you an audience when he returns, and then you may see this too." We went upstairs, and she took me to the building situated on the other side of the palace. When she opened the heavy door, I could hardly believe my eyes. There was a large hall measuring about 40 by 40 yards full of delicious flowers. The glass house was just as good as any of the best to be found in botanical gardens in the West. The hall was divided into various compartments, kept at different temperatures by hot water pipes. The greenhouse was nothing exceptional in itself, but it seemed to be almost a miracle to find such a thing in the Tibetan valley. "This is his private garden," she said with the deepest respect. "This is where he, our prince, Mani Rinpoche, the exalted jewel or prince of light, deigns to take his afternoon walks. The glass house is directly connected with the palace by a subterranean passage." We had entered a compartment where tropical plants were kept. "May I ask you what kind of fuel you use in the holy city in your central heating system?" "We use alcohol," she answered. "It burns smokelessly." "From where do you get it?" "We distill it ourselves. The distillery is in the building just opposite. The building is used for distilling, cooking, washing linen, centers of sanitation, and as a residential building for several hundred servants." We left the glass house. "The building over there is the residential house of our members," she said. "You will live in the guest house, opposite. You can come and go as you like. You will see the dining building very soon, when we take breakfast. I will now show you rapidly the building used for cooking and sanitation." We walked over to the other building and went downstairs. A heavy door stood wide open. There was a large announcement which proclaimed that members, guests, and servants had to use the sanitary conveniences in that building, which was connected for that purpose with the other buildings by subterranean passages. "Would it not be more practical to install sanitary conveniences in each of the other buildings?" I ventured to ask the superintendent of the building, a middle-aged man wearing a cheap silk robe. "No," he said, "there are occult reasons for this strict rule. Al-Alam pure organic matter here instantly goes into a fire kept burning day and night. Everybody in the holy city must go to the inconvenience of walking a few hundred yards from his or her building to this one. This is a sacrifice brought to the purity of the holy city." In saying so, his tone denoted considerable contempt for impure organic matter. I could not help thinking that respect of the Creator automatically implied a deep respect for our own bodies, and that the contempt of physical needs was nothing short of a sin. Up to that time I had maintained a very critical and matter-of-fact attitude about everything I saw or heard in the city of the initiates. Strange to say, after taking my first meal in the dining building, I stopped viewing things in this manner and suddenly became enthusiastic about everything in the holy city, as if I had swallowed with the food a strange capacity for uncritical enthusiasm. Several hundred members and guests of the Holy Brotherhood were present in the dining building to take breakfast. The meal was served in a large hall measuring about 40 by 40 yards. There were many elevated platforms, footnote. the participants being seated on them in circles of 9 people each, each person sitting on an expensive cushion of the very highest quality. Dozens of those dreadful lifeless servants whom I greatly disliked until I had taken my first meal in the holy city moved about noiselessly on thick carpets. The food was sent over from the kitchen and sanitation building through an underground passage. Everything seemed to be very well organized. Servants came and went at regular intervals, and one of them even seemed to regulate the traffic. Footnote. Some of my readers will have wondered how the Brotherhood obtained the means of living. If only a few dozen out of the several hundred members of the fraternity were about as wealthy as Naboo, all expenses could be met out of their voluntary contributions, all the more so as it is highly probable that the servants of the colony receive no wages at all. Furthermore, the perfect organization of the Holy City tends to reduce expenses by rendering waste impossible. As to the food supplies to the city, only a portion of the actual needs of the Brotherhood seems to have been purchased from the outside world. There were vast underground halls covered with glass which were not accessible, and these may have been used for growing some food on scientific lines. If the number 9 seems to be the holy number in the holy city, although 7 also frequently occurred. There were 7 buildings. The guest house had 90 guest rooms. The gong was sounded 9 times before meals. 8 set for a few of the members could speak broken English about as much as Lam O Chun, and 2 of them happened to sit in my circle. When I saw the servant regulating the traffic at the entrance to the passage leading to the kitchen building, I cracked a joke about the city having an equivalent of traffic constables in the West, and accompanied the jest by a laugh. The others looked greatly shocked. I was at once politely but very firmly informed by a kind of superintendent dressed in cheap silk that laughter was forbidden in the holy city. I then learned from the other members in my circle that not only laughter but also speaking in a loud voice was a breach of the rules. Only conversation in a low voice was tolerated. Among the people seated in my circle many were clairvoyants. They were very proud of their occult achievements. They also felt proud that they had been selected by Mani Rinpoche, the exalted jewel, to serve him in the great mission of bringing illumination to the world. The exact hierarchical order of the members of the Holy Brotherhood headed by the Prince of Light or exalted jewel, occasionally briefly referred to as him, was a secret. The members passed through successive initiations, each initiation raising them to a higher degree in the hierarchy of light. Amongst the lofty titles I heard while I stayed in the Valley of Mystery there were such as Dispensers of the Divine Wisdom, Masters of Light, Disciples of Light, Saviors of Souls, Lords of Compassion, Illuminated Teachers, and so forth. Each initiation tied the holder of the title more closely to the head of the Brotherhood, and I think the holders of the highest degrees had no separate personality left at all and were mere agents of the Divine Will, Heart, Body and soul. In return for their pledging themselves to the light they obtained greater occult powers and spiritual energies on the understanding that all of them would be used only in the interest of the Brotherhood and for no other purpose. Any thought of sex in the holy city seemed to be regarded as contemptible and beneath the dignity of such highly spiritual people. I looked around and saw Lam O Chun seated in one of the other circles at a distance of about 10 yards. No one seemed to be aware of the very existence of sex in the holy city when looking at a man or a woman, no matter how handsome or beautiful he or she happened to be. After breakfast one had to comply with the only formality compulsory to guests visiting the holy city. On entering the guest house I had to hand over to the superintendent a small piece of paper on which I had written a few words in Tibetan letters. I entered my room. It was fairly large and splendidly lit by the enormous window covering the whole ceiling. It was early in the hot summer afternoon, but nevertheless the room remained cool owing to the automatic device mentioned before by which varying amounts of water could be poured out over the glass roofs to regulate the temperature. Ventilation was effected by a system of pipes probably leading to a kind of fan serving the whole building and kept going continually by the servants. Footnote. As the superintendent knew that I was a white person they had put in a western bed. The door of the room could be bolted from the inside and everything was scrupulously clean. The superintendent had told me that I could do everything in my room except eating and washing my linen. The rooms must not be desecrated by eating, he said, and the washing of clothes, etc., was to be done by the servants in the sanitation building. Everything seemed to be all right as far as physical comfort was concerned, except the prospect of having to walk again and again many hundred yards to go to the sanitation building, and being a man of a free and independent disposition, I at once decided to simplify matters in this respect by setting aside the largest of my bottles for a convenient purpose denied to me by the strict rules of the house. The whole psychical atmosphere of the city seemed to be very strange and had a tendency to develop latent powers in man. When I left the guest building in the morning, the outer door was sometimes closed, but on other occasions it stood wide open. Strange to say, I always felt before I left my room whether the outer door was open or closed, and this vague feeling footnote. When passing the door of the house, I had noticed that it was quite an exceptional entrance for a Tibetan building. It looked absolutely air and watertight. Moreover, when I entered my room, I found that there was no possibility of opening any of the glass slabs of which the ceiling consisted, ventilation being effected through a system of air pipes. Did all this indicate that the underground city had been built with a view to the possibility of flooding it in case of emergency? It was not what is known as clairvoyance, proved to be correct on all occasions, for when I reached the outer door after passing through two different corridors situated at right angles, I always found that the outer door stood open, half open, or was closed, just as I had sensed it in my room. The phenomenon was inexplicable, but it was a fact, subjectively. Footnote. A second very strange experience I had the same day when I walked over to the sanitation building to pour out the contents of the bottle I had provided in my room for a convenient purpose. I found that the liquid had turned black. One at the moment I attributed the fact to the food, and a few minutes later I had forgotten all about it. The psychical atmosphere of the city seemed to render critical and methodical thinking very difficult. It tended to weaken memory. I had been in the city for less than 10 hours and felt as if these hours had been so many years, but it seemed to develop the intuitional nature of man to a remarkable degree. When I had returned to my room, I heard the noise of numerous footsteps on the glass roof. One could hear the rumble of thunder in the distance, and as the Tibetan thunderstorms are usually very violent in the summer and are often accompanied by hailstones, a kind of thick cloth or thin mattress was put on the glass roofs to protect them from footnote. The members of the secret society could not leave the city unless sent out on special missions assigned to them by the ruler. Their life seemed to be regulated like that of the inhabitants of an anthill. And as to the servants, they seemed to be so devoid of life and supra-animal intelligence that it seemed to be impossible for them to do anything except their duties. The hail. I went upstairs to watch these proceedings and found that the surface of the buildings was teeming with perhaps 100 of those lifeless servants, who were assisted by a large number of mechanically moving children whose lifeless glaze reminding one of a corpse was perhaps even more unpleasant than the expression or rather lack of any expression in the eyes of the servants. The room was darkened by the mattresses put on the glass roofs and, after having lit a lamp, I sat down to study. They had specially provided for me a kind of case to serve the purpose of a Western table and a Western chair. Half an hour later, 9 loud strokes of a gong were heard, and as I had not risen within 20 seconds to leave the room to go to the dining building, a lifeless servant came in without knocking and said, "My lord, our guest, will you please go to the second meal of the day?" In the dining hall I met Naobu, who had just arrived from his tsong. He looked very fit. Only the expression of his eyes seemed to have altered a little. They were still beautiful, but had just a slight touch of a glassy appearance which I did not like at all. He seemed to occupy a very high rank in the occult hierarchy, as the other members seemed to approach him with unusual marks of respect. Naobu informed me that Mani Rinpoche, the exalted jewel or prince of light, the ruler of the holy city, was expected to return the following day and that it was quite possible that I would be granted the privilege of an audience. There were cases, he added, where acquaintances of certain members of the Holy Brotherhood had sacrificed their whole fortune and travelled 1,000 miles to obtain an audience of him lasting only 2 minutes. If he succeeded in arranging the audience with the exalted jewel, I might ask the Prince of Light for permission to attend divine service. Only members were allowed to enter the temple, and guests who had not yet pledged themselves to anything required a special permit for doing so, which could only be granted by the exalted Prince of Light himself. The next few days would be of vital importance for me, said Naobu. No one here had a right to force my hand, and I had to decide quite freely whether I wanted to become a member. I was quite free to come and go as I liked, and so long as I had not taken a pledge, I was under no obligation to the Holy Brotherhood. Then he whispered, many of us here realize of what enormous value you could be to us if you decided to join us of your own free will. He even hinted at a quick rise in the ranks of the hierarchy, rapidly succeeding initiations, and the possibility of my being entrusted with a really big job once I had decided to become a member. I pointed out that I had never joined any association or fraternity of any kind, and that up to the present I had at all times made an effort to maintain absolute independence in every respect, and that I felt considerable reluctance to relinquish that attitude. It is you who will have to decide, he said, and the moment you have taken your decision, the Prince of Light will assign to you the exalted position in which you will be most useful. I thought that I had always assigned myself my own position, and that I had acquired knowledge and priceless experience by doing so, but I could not examine things in the city quite as intelligently as I could have done in a really neutral atmosphere. I felt as if my capacity to think deeply and freely and to weigh matters coolly was impaired by my very presence in it. And as I am a man of what occultists call the lion temperament, although very meek when I want to be meek, everything in me revolted. I then almost cursed the atmosphere of that city. I had to think of a passage in the drama Faust, by Goethe, where the devil says to himself after leaving a prospective victim, "Contempt your capacity to think, which is man's greatest power, welcome misty things and sorcery and either spirit of illusion, then I shall get you surely enough." Then I again looked at Naobu and felt ashamed to have entertained such thoughts. He seemed to feel so sincere about it. He wanted me to join a brotherhood working for the good of the world, and gave me freedom to make my choice. The pendulum swung back once more, and I felt a perfect beast to have entertained these thoughts. There was lively conversation in our circle, although everybody seemed to take pains not to raise his voice. Alel, these people were a little proud to have the privilege of working for the world. They had a rather high opinion of their own spirituality. Some of them even linked up the Prince of Light with certain highly placed spiritual entities who are what Hindu philosophers call karmic agents and regulate the unloading of karmic reactions on men and nations. Some of them even seemed to feel that the Holy Ruler could actually influence the destinies of the world by hastening or retarding the outbreak of wars, the evolution of new types of epidemics and the disappearance of older kinds of disease, as well as the action of other scourges of humanity, including the various catastrophes of nature. They seemed to consider the Holy Jewel as a kind of supreme judge dispensing divine justice, and naturally felt very elated at the thought of standing so near a being who possessed all these powers. Human intelligence, they only held in mediocre esteem. They seemed to feel that man's mission was to get past the human stage, and that passing beyond the limited matter-of-fact intelligence of man and soaring to intuitive levels was the best method of becoming more divine. Again the pendulum of my disposition towards the city swayed in the opposite direction. I thought of the devil speaking in Goethe's Faust, the verses cited above, but it was enough for me to look once more at Naobu to make the pendulum swing back again. The longer I stayed in the holy city, the more I seemed to be overcome by a frightful state of indecision and experienced the most acute sense of spiritual anguish. At times I felt as if the ground disappeared under my feet, that everything was in a state of flux, and as if I were tossed about by conflicting spiritual currents. I listened to Naobu while he took part in the conversation. I felt as if his voice had become still more metallic and hollow. When I made a few casual remarks, I began to pay attention to my own voice, and found, to my astonishment, that it sounded unusually hollow too. The fine individual touch which a man's personality gives to his voice, footnote, seemed to be absent. I listened to the conversation of the people seated in the neighboring circle. They were talking on evolution. People in the city did not seem to talk much about any human topics. All of them seemed to want to get past the human stage and to be godlike. One of them envisaged the glory of evolution, life passing from the mineral stage through plants, animals, man and angels up to the archangelic and divine stages, every creature automatically becoming a god. And one day it would be godlike. It was only a question of time. Glory, in their eyes, seemed to be the automatic and inevitable destiny of man. They did not seem to be aware of the dreadful alternative of annihilation, of the fact footnote. Especially people who have gone through great soul passion, this greatest gift of God, as it welds us more and more into one unit with our soul, have a fine human touch in their voices. I imagine Shakespeare, the real Shakespeare who sketched all those wonderful characters having souls of their own, must have had this beautiful timbre in his voice, making one think of an angel of the Creator. That there is a downward trend of satanic evolution as a counterpart to the upward trend of divine evolution. They seemed to feel that the great spiritual struggle was between spirit and matter. They seemed to utterly ignore the vital fact that there are two different types of spirituality. The upward trend and the lower one, and that the real spiritual struggle is one between two different types of spirituality with matter serving as the battleground. The food of the second meal of the day consisted of 9 different dishes served in fairly rapid succession so that the second meal of the day, only 2 meals were taken per day, should not last longer than about an hour. The food was served on silver plates of very original design. It tasted very nice, but it was very difficult to know exactly of what it consisted. It obviously contained some meat, a fact I immediately noticed because I happened to eat meat only occasionally. Most of the food was a kind of ragu. The 9 dishes served varied in taste, but the contents of each plate were one uniform mass of food. The quantities served were small. The contents of all the 9 plates put together hardly equaled in quantity about half the amount of food eaten by an average Londoner for dinner. The food was strangely nourishing and satisfying. All the substances which might have caused flatulence seemed to have been eliminated with the greatest care. Nawabu invited me to join a few other members of the Holy Brotherhood after dinner, but I thanked him and went to bed soon after 8:00. Understood that the life of the Holy City only reached its culminating point late in the evening, most of the members and guests going to bed between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. I had a dreadfully restless night, perhaps the worst I had had for years. I tossed wildly about, shaken by terrible dreams. Sometimes when I was halfway between waking and dreaming, I felt as though the room was filled with demons in white clothes with a slight reddish touch, trying to tear my heart open and take something out of it with their horrible claws. My whole body writhed with pain and I was bathed in perspiration. 2 or 3 light figures, who were somewhat like the other demons, stood near me. They looked like boys of about 16, and their eyes flashed like so many sheets of lightning every time the demons made a dash for my heart, and thus drove them back again and again. The nightmare increased in intensity. My whole body shivered. I passed through the stages of half slumber, deep sleep, and full consciousness with incredible rapidity. When fully conscious, I thought I had caught some serious infectious disease causing high fever. A few seconds later I was again in a semi-conscious condition. Hundreds of white angels with a slight reddish touch on their bright garments and having beautiful but dismal eyes, all of them having almost the same face, advanced threateningly, their white claws all aimed at my heart as if they were determined to snatch something hidden in it. When this dreadful army approached once more, the boys dressed in white advanced to protect me. Their faces had an individual touch, each boy having a facial expression entirely different from the other. Their eyes flashed and sheets of lightning came out from them directed at those demons dressed in beautiful and resplendent reddish-white robes. but the flashes of lightning were too weak to hold the whole army of demons at bay. The boys recoiled. For the first time, an indescribable expression of anxiety came into their handsome faces. I awoke to full consciousness. My whole body was writhing. I had high fever. My lips were parched and my tongue dry.